Welcome to SCOTUSCast, Copyright Act and Foreign Textbooks Edition. Thank you for tuning in. On April 25th, 2016, the Supreme Court heard oral arguments in Kurtzsang v. John Wiley & Sons. Academic textbook publisher John Wiley & Sons, Inc. owns the American copyright for textbooks and often assigns its rights to its foreign subsidiaries to publish, print, and sell its textbooks abroad. Supap Kurtzsang, a Thai citizen who came to the United States in 1997 to study mathematics, asked friends and family in Thailand to buy the English language versions of his textbooks in Thailand, where they were cheaper, and mail them to him. Kurtzsang would then sell these textbooks in America, reimburse his friends and family, and make a profit. In 2008, Wiley sued Kurtzsang for copyright infringement. He ultimately prevailed before the U.S. Supreme Court on the question of whether the first sale doctrine, under which the owner of a lawfully made copy can dispose of it without permission of the copyright owner, applies to copies of a copyrighted work lawfully made abroad. On remand, the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Second Circuit ruled that the first sale doctrine provided Kurtzsang with a complete defense to Wiley's infringement claim. Kurtzsang thereafter sought an award of attorney's fees pursuant to Section 505 of the Copyright Act, which allows the award of fees to a prevailing party at the court's discretion. The federal courts of appeals have applied several different standards in resolving such fee requests. Here, the Second Circuit affirmed the denial of attorney's fees to Kurtzsang based on the district court's view that Wiley had taken an objectively reasonable position in the underlying litigation. The U.S. Supreme Court again granted certiorari to address the following question: what is the appropriate standard for awarding attorney's fees to a prevailing party under Section 505 of the Copyright Act? To discuss the case, we have Christopher M. Newman, who is Associate Professor of Law at George Mason University School of Law. As always, the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker. And now, Professor Newman.
This case concerns the proper construction of Section 505 of Title 17, which provides that in a copyright action, the court may award a reasonable attorney's fee to the prevailing party. Petitioner Kurtzsang was sued by John Wiley for copyright infringement, and after losing at both the district and circuit court levels, ultimately prevailed in the Supreme Court. Kurtzsang then moved for attorney fees under Section 505, but the district court denied the motion, and this denial was upheld by the Second Circuit. Second Circuit precedent gives substantial weight to the question whether the losing party's litigation position was objectively unreasonable, and as I'll explain in a moment, John Wiley's position in this litigation clearly was not. Kurtzsang contends that this is the wrong standard and that a court should award fees even against a losing party whose position is reasonable if it finds the litigation to have served the purposes of the Copyright Act. Here it's worth saying a bit more about the underlying litigation. John Wiley & Company had sued Kurtzsang for running an enterprise that purchased textbooks in Thailand and imported them into the U.S. for sale. Wiley argued that this violated Section 602 of the Copyright Act, which, as written, grants copyright owners the exclusive right to import copies of their works into the U.S. Kurtzsang contended that because the copies had been lawfully made and purchased abroad, their importation was immunized under the first sale provisions of Section 109. Now, the interplay between those two conflicting provisions prevented a difficult question of statutory interpretation, both because of certain ambiguous language in the statute and because of the construction the court had given to these provisions in an earlier case. As Kurtzsang points out here in its opening brief, however, at the time of the litigation, every circuit court to have addressed the question, as well as all the major copyright treatises, agreed that Kurtzsang's position was wrong and that copies created in foreign countries did not trigger first sale. The Supreme Court ultimately held in a split 6-3 decision that first sale does apply to copies lawfully created abroad, meaning that the exclusive importation right can no longer be used to protect a strategy of price discrimination between various national and international markets. So there's no doubt that Wiley's position was reasonable, nor is there any doubt that this was a very significant ruling that changed the face of copyright law. Kirtsang argues that this sort of situation, in which you have a relatively small defendant persisting against all odds to achieve a result that changes or clarifies the applicable law, is precisely the type of scenario in which attorney's fees should be awarded, because you want to incentivize such defendants to keep litigating in order to achieve the end result of advancing the purposes of the Copyright Act. Petitioner's opening brief begins by asking, if not Kirtsang, then who? Kirtsang argues that in deciding whether to award fees, a court should ask itself whether doing so in this particular case would advance the purposes of the Copyright Act. To decide this, the court should, according to petitioner, consider the totality of the circumstances, including the importance of the result and the relative resources of the parties, and ask itself whether, if this same scenario were to present itself again, the availability of fees would incentivize beneficial litigation. Kirtsang further contends that a standard placing heavy weight on whether the losing party's position was reasonable tends to lead to a playing field tilted systematically against defendants. Assertedly, this is because in practice, losing defendants will be regarded as unreasonable, whereas winning defendants will have the burden of showing the plaintiff's position to have been unreasonable. Now, on its face, it's not clear why one would necessarily expect to find any such asymmetry. There's no reason why a court couldn't apply a reasonableness standard even-handedly, denying fees both to the prevailing defendant in cases like Kirtsang, but also denying them to a prevailing plaintiff in cases where, for example, the defendant made a fair use argument that ultimately loses, but that was worthy of serious consideration. And a fair amount of time at oral argument was actually devoted to this question whether empirically there really is any significant disparity between the rates at which fees are granted to prevailing defendants versus plaintiffs, and if so, what that might mean. Kirtsang contended that in the Second Circuit, prevailing defendants get fees 44% of the time as opposed to 85% for prevailing plaintiffs. The United States, which appeared as an amicus in support of respondent, contended that if you exclude all of the small uncontested fee awards that often take place in connection with default judgments, much of the disparity in success rate actually disappears and that there's really no approach that you would expect to result in perfect parity. Several of the justices at argument expressed skepticism both about the workability of Kirtsang's proposed approach and whether it would have desirable results. With regard to workability, both Justices Breyer and Alito questioned how exactly a judge is supposed to decide whether a given case has furthered the purposes of the Copyright Act and whether we could expect to see any sort of predictability based on a standard like that. Justice Kagan suggested that from an ex-ante perspective, the objective reasonableness standard might actually be better for most little guys in Kirtsang's position, because what it does is provide a safe harbor in which you can at least be sure that as long as you're taking a reasonable position, you're not at risk of being saddled with the plaintiff's attorney's fees. And along similar lines, the respondent argued that the Second Circuit approach is actually the one that creates the best incentives, because what it does is encourage litigation of the truly difficult cases without fear of fee shifting on either side, while deterring parties from taking frivolous positions. Now, of course, it's always perilous to make predictions based on what the justices say at oral argument. All things considered, though, I would be surprised to see the court come out adopting anything like the sort of open-ended approach advanced here by the petitioner. If I had to guess, I'd say that the most likely result is that the court will affirm the Second Circuit, but perhaps issue an opinion clarifying that it understands their approach to be one that does not necessarily give dispositive weight in all circumstances to the reasonableness of the losing party's position, but that leaves open the possibility that this might be outweighed in appropriate cases by other factors, such as perhaps improper litigation conduct or idiosyncratic circumstances that we're not going to try to predict in a categorical rule ex ante.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUS Cast. For more episodes of SCOTUS Cast, as well as audio and video of past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at www.federalistsociety.org/multimedia.